high degree of marital infidelity, maternal uncles should be more altruistic than apparent fathers, since they have more grounds for confidence in their relatedness to the child. They know that the child's mother is at least their half-sister. The legal father knows nothing.
End note. Originally I wrote, I do not know of any evidence bearing on these predictions, but I offer them in the hope that others may, or may start looking for evidence. In particular, perhaps social anthropologists might have interesting things to say. This remark now makes me blush with embarrassment. I have since learned that social anthropologists not only have things to say about the mother's brother effect, many of them have for years spoken of little else. The effect that I predicted is an empirical fact in a large number of cultures that has been well known to anthropologists for decades. Moreover, when I suggested the specific hypothesis that, in a society with a high degree of marital infidelity, maternal uncles should be more altruistic than apparent fathers, I regrettably overlooked the fact that Richard Alexander had already made the same suggestion. A footnote acknowledging this was inserted in later printings of the first edition of the book. The hypothesis has been tested, by Alexander himself among others, using quantitative counts from the anthropological literature, with favourable results.
Returning to the fact that parental altruism is more common than fraternal altruism, it does seem reasonable to explain this in terms of the identification problem. But this does not explain the fundamental asymmetry in the parent-child relationship itself. Parents care more for their children than children do for their parents, although the genetic relationship is symmetrical and certainty of relatedness is just as great both ways. One reason is that parents are in a better practical position to help their young, being older and more competent at the business of living. Even if a baby wanted to feed its parents, it's not well equipped to do so in practice. There is another asymmetry in the parent-child relationship which does not apply to the brother-sister one. Children are always younger than their parents. This often, though not always, means they have a longer expectation of life. As emphasized above, expectation of life is an important variable which, in the best of all possible worlds, should enter into an animal's calculation when it is deciding whether to behave altruistically or not. In a species in which children have a longer average life expectancy than parents, any gene for child altruism would be labouring under a disadvantage. It would be engineering altruistic self-sacrifice for the benefit of individuals who are nearer to dying of old age than the altruist itself. A gene for parent altruism, on the other hand, would have a corresponding advantage as far as the life expectancy terms in the equation were concerned.
One sometimes hears it said that kin selection is all very well as a theory, but there are few examples of its working in practice. This criticism can only be made by someone who does not understand what kin selection means. The truth is that all examples of child protection and parental care and all associated bodily organs, milk-secreting glands, kangaroo pouches and so on, are examples of the working in nature of the kin selection principle. The critics are, of course, familiar with the widespread existence of parental care, but they fail to understand that parental care is no less an example of kin selection than brother-sister altruism. When they say they want examples, they mean that they want examples other than parental care, and it is true that such examples are less common. I have suggested reasons why this might be so. I could have gone out of my way to quote examples of brother-sister altruism. There are, in fact, quite a few. But I don't want to do this because it would reinforce the erroneous idea, favoured as we have seen by Wilson, that kin selection is specifically about relationships other than the parent-child relationship. The reason this error has grown up is largely historical. The evolutionary advantage of parental care is so obvious that we did not have to wait for Hamilton to point it out. It has been understood ever since Darwin. When Hamilton demonstrated the genetic equivalence of other relationships and their evolutionary significance, he naturally had to lay stress on these other relationships. In particular, he drew examples from the social insects, such as ants and bees, in which the sister-sister relationship is particularly important, as we shall see in a later chapter. I have even heard people say that they thought Hamilton's theory applied only to the social insects. If anybody does not want to admit that parental care is an example of kin selection in action, then the onus is on him to formulate a general theory of natural selection that predicts parental altruism, but does not predict altruism between collateral kin. I think he will fail. Chapter 7. Family Planning. It is easy to see why some people have wanted to separate parental care from the other kinds of kin-selected altruism. Parental care looks like an integral part of reproduction, whereas, for example, altruism toward a nephew is not. I think there really is an important distinction hidden here, but that people have mistaken what the distinction is. They have put reproduction and parental care on one side and other sorts of altruism on the other. But I wish to make a distinction between bringing new individuals into the world on the one hand and caring for existing individuals on the other. I shall call these two activities respectively child-bearing and child-caring. An individual survival machine has to make two quite different sorts of decisions, caring decisions and bearing decisions. I use the word decision to mean unconscious strategic move. The caring decisions are of this form. There is a child. Its degree of relatedness to me is so-and-so. Its chances of dying, if I do not feed it, are such-and-such. Shall I feed it? Bearing decisions, on the other hand, are like this. Shall I take whatever steps are necessary in order to bring a new individual into the world? Shall I reproduce? To some extent, caring and bearing are bound to compete with each other for an individual's time and other resources. The individual may have to make a choice. Shall I care for this child, or shall I bear a new one?
Depending on the ecological details of the species, various mixes of caring and bearing strategies can be evolutionarily stable. The one thing that cannot be evolutionarily stable is a pure caring strategy. If all individuals devoted themselves to caring for existing children to such an extent that they never brought any new ones into the world, the population would quickly become invaded by mutant individuals who specialized in bearing. Caring can only be evolutionarily stable as part of a mixed strategy. At least some bearing has to go on. The species with which we are most familiar, mammals and birds, tend to be great carers. A decision to bear a new child is usually followed by a decision to care for it. It is because bearing and caring so often go together in practice that people have muddled the two things up. But from the point of view of the selfish genes, there is, as we have seen, no distinction in principle between caring for a baby brother and caring for a baby son. Both infants are equally closely related to you. If you have to choose between feeding one or the other, there is no genetic reason why you should choose your own son. But on the other hand, you cannot, by definition, bear a baby brother. You can only care for him once somebody else has brought him into the world. In the last chapter, we looked at how individual survival machines ideally should decide whether to behave altruistically towards other individuals who already exist. In this chapter, we look at how they should decide whether to bring new individuals into the world. It is over this matter that the controversy about group selection mentioned in Chapter 1 has chiefly raged. This is because Wynne Edwards, who's been mainly responsible for promulgating the idea of group selection, did so in the context of a theory of population regulation. Wynne Edwards suggested that individual animals deliberately and altruistically reduce their birth rates for the good of the group as a whole. This is a very attractive hypothesis because it fits so well with what individual humans ought to do. Mankind is having too many children.
End note. Wynne Edwards is generally treated more kindly than academic heretics often are. By being wrong in an unequivocal way, he is widely credited, though I personally think this point is rather overdone, with having provoked people into thinking more clearly about selection. He himself made a magnanimous recantation in 1978 when he wrote,
The general consensus of theoretical biologists at present is that credible models cannot be devised by which the slow march of group selection could overtake the much faster spread of selfish genes that bring gains in individual fitness. I therefore accept their opinion.
Magnanimous these second thoughts may have been, but unfortunately he has had third ones. His latest book re-recants. Group selection, in the sense in which we have all long understood it, is even more out of favour among biologists than it was when my first edition was published. You could be forgiven for thinking the opposite. A generation has grown up, especially in America, that scatters the name group selection around like confetti. It is littered over all kinds of cases that used to be, and by the rest of us still are, clearly and straightforwardly understood as something else, say kin selection. I suppose it is futile to become too annoyed by such semantic parvenus. Nevertheless, the whole issue of group selection was very satisfactorily settled a decade ago by John Maynard Smith and others, and it is irritating to find that we are now two generations as well as two nations, divided only by a common language. It is particularly unfortunate that philosophers, now belatedly entering the field, have started out muddled by this recent caprice of terminology. I recommend Alan Graffen's essay, Natural Selection, Kin Selection and Group Selection, as a clear-thinking, and I hope now definitive, sorting out of these neo-group selection problems.
Population size depends upon four things: births, deaths, immigrations and emigrations. Taking the world population as a whole, immigrations and emigrations do not occur, and we are left with births and deaths. So long as the average number of children per couple is larger than two, surviving to reproduce, the numbers of babies born will tend to increase over the years at an ever-accelerating rate. In each generation, the population, instead of going up by a fixed amount, increases by something more like a fixed proportion of the size that it has already reached. Since this size is itself getting bigger, the size of the increment gets bigger. If this kind of growth was allowed to go on unchecked, a population would reach astronomical proportions surprisingly quickly. Incidentally, a thing that is sometimes not realized even by people who worry about population problems is that population growth depends on when people have children as well as on how many they have. Since populations tend to increase by a certain proportion per generation, it follows that if you space the generations out more, the population will grow at a slower rate per year. Banners that read, "Stop at 2," could equally well be changed to, "Start at 30." But in any case, accelerating population growth spells serious trouble. We have probably all seen examples of the startling calculations that can be used to bring this home. For instance, the present population of Latin America is around 300 million, and already many of them are undernourished. But if the population continued to increase at the present rate, it would take less than 500 years to reach the point where the people, packed in a standing position, formed a solid human carpet over the whole area of the continent. This is so even if we assume them to be very skinny, a not unrealistic assumption. In 1,000 years from now, they would be standing on each other's shoulders more than a million deep. By 2,000 years, the mountain of people travelling outwards at the speed of light would have reached the edge of the known universe.
It will not have escaped you that this is a hypothetical calculation. It will not really happen like that for some very good practical reasons. The names of some of these reasons are famine, plague, and war, or, if we are lucky, birth control. It is no use appealing to advances in agricultural science, green revolutions, and the like. Increases in food production may temporarily alleviate the problem, but it is mathematically certain that they cannot be a long-term solution. Indeed, like the medical advances that have precipitated the crisis, they may well make the problem worse by speeding up the rate of the population expansion. It is a simple logical truth that, short of mass emigration into space, with rockets taking off at the rate of several million per second, uncontrolled birth rates are bound to lead to horribly increased death rates. It is hard to believe that this simple truth is not understood by those leaders who forbid their followers to use effective contraceptive methods. They express a preference for natural methods of population limitation. And a natural method is exactly what they are going to get. It is called starvation. But of course, the unease that such long-term calculations arouse is based on concern for the future welfare of our species as a whole. Humans, some of them, have the conscious foresight to see ahead to the disastrous consequences of overpopulation. It is the basic assumption of this book that survival machines in general are guided by selfish genes, who most certainly cannot be expected to see into the future, nor to have the welfare of the whole species at heart. This is where Wynne Edwards parts company with orthodox evolutionary theorists. He thinks there is a way in which genuine altruistic birth control can evolve.
A point that is not emphasized in the writings of Wynne Edwards or in Ardrey's popularization of his views is that there is a large body of agreed facts that are not in dispute. It is an obvious fact that wild animal populations do not grow at the astronomical rates of which they are theoretically capable. Sometimes wild animal populations remain rather stable, with birth rates and death rates roughly keeping pace with each other. In many cases, lemmings being a famous example, the population fluctuates widely, with violent explosions alternating with crashes and near extinction. Occasionally the result is outright extinction, at least of the population in a local area. Sometimes, as in the case of the Canadian lynx, where estimates are obtained from the number of pelts sold by the Hudson's Bay Company in successive years, the population seems to oscillate rhythmically. The one thing animal populations do not do is go on increasing indefinitely. Wild animals almost never die of old age. Starvation, disease, or predators catch up with them long before they become really senile. Until recently, this was true of man, too. Most animals die in childhood. Many never get beyond the egg stage. Starvation and other causes of death are the ultimate reasons why populations cannot increase indefinitely. But as we have seen for our own species, there is no necessary reason why it ever has to come to that. If only animals would regulate their birth rates, starvation need never happen. It is Wynne Edwards' thesis that that is exactly what they do. But even here there is less disagreement than you might think from reading his book. Adherents of the selfish gene theory would readily agree that animals do regulate their birth rates. Any given species tends to have a rather fixed clutch size or litter size. No animal has an infinite number of children. The disagreement comes not over whether birth rates are regulated. The disagreement is over why they are regulated, by what process of natural selection has family planning evolved. In a nutshell, the disagreement is over whether animal birth control is altruistic, practiced for the good of the group as a whole, or selfish, practiced for the good of the individual doing the reproducing. Let us deal with the two theories in order.
Wynne Edwards supposed that individuals have fewer children than they are capable of for the benefit of the group as a whole. He recognized that normal natural selection cannot possibly give rise to the evolution of such altruism. The natural selection of lower than average reproductive rates is, on the face of it, a contradiction in terms. He therefore invoked group selection, as we saw in Chapter 1. According to him, groups whose individual members restrain their own birth rates are less likely to go extinct than rival groups whose individual members reproduce so fast that they endanger the food supply. Therefore, the world becomes populated by groups of restrained breeders. The individual restraint that Wynne Edwards is suggesting amounts in a general sense to birth control, but he is more specific than this, and indeed comes up with a grand conception in which the whole of social life is seen as a mechanism of population regulation. For instance, two major features of social life in many species of animals are territoriality and dominance hierarchies, already mentioned in Chapter 5.
Many animals devote a great deal of time and energy to apparently defending an area of ground which naturalists call a territory. The phenomenon is very widespread in the animal kingdom, not only in birds, mammals and fish, but in insects and even sea anemones. The territory may be a large area of woodland, which is the principal foraging ground of a breeding pair, as in the case of robins. Or in herring gulls, for instance, it may be a small area containing no food, but with a nest at its centre. Wynne Edwards believes that animals who fight over territory are fighting over a token prize rather than an actual prize like a bit of food. In many cases, females refuse to mate with males who do not possess a territory. Indeed, it often happens that a female whose mate is defeated and his territory conquered promptly attaches herself to the victor. Even in apparently faithful monogamous species, the female may be wedded to a male's territory rather than to him personally. If the population gets too big, some individuals will not get territories and therefore will not breed. Winning a territory is, therefore, to Wynne Edwards, like winning a ticket or license to breed. Since there is a finite number of territories available, it is as if a finite number of breeding licenses is issued. Individuals may fight over who gets these licenses, but the total number of babies that the population can have as a whole is limited by the number of territories available. In some cases, for instance in red grouse, individuals do, at first sight, seem to show restraint, because those who cannot win territories not only do not breed, they also appear to give up the struggle to win a territory. It is as though they all accepted the rules of the game, that if, by the end of the competition season, you have not secured one of the official tickets to breed, you voluntarily refrain from breeding and leave the lucky ones unmolested during the breeding season so that they can get on with propagating the species.
Wynne Edwards interprets dominance hierarchies in a similar way. In many groups of animals, especially in captivity, but also in some cases in the wild, individuals learn each other's identity, and they learn whom they can beat in a fight and who usually beats them. As we saw in Chapter 5, they tend to submit without a struggle to individuals who they know are likely to beat them anyway. As a result, a naturalist is able to describe a dominance hierarchy, or peck order, so-called because it was first described for hens, a rank ordering of society in which everybody knows his place and does not get ideas above his station. Of course, sometimes real earnest fights do take place, and sometimes individuals can win promotion over their former immediate bosses. But as we saw in Chapter 5, the overall effect of the automatic submission by lower-ranking individuals is that few prolonged fights actually take place, and serious injuries seldom occur. Many people think of this as a good thing in some vaguely group selectionist way. Wynne Edwards has an altogether more daring interpretation. High-ranking individuals are more likely to breed than low-ranking individuals, either because they are preferred by females or because they physically prevent low-ranking males from getting near females. Wynne Edwards sees high social rank as another ticket of entitlement to reproduce. Instead of fighting directly over females themselves, individuals fight over social status and then accept that if they do not end up high on the social scale, they are not entitled to breed. They restrain themselves where females are directly concerned, though they may try every now and then to win higher status and therefore could be said to compete indirectly over females. But as in the case of territorial behaviour, the result of this voluntary acceptance of the rule that only high-status males should breed is, according to Wynne Edwards, that populations do not grow too fast. Instead of actually having too many children and then finding out the hard way that it was a mistake, populations use formal contests over status and territory as a means of limiting their size slightly below the level at which starvation itself actually takes its toll. Perhaps the most startling of Wynne Edwards's ideas is that of epideictic behaviour, a word that he coined himself. Many animals spend a great deal of time in large flocks, herds or shoals. Various more or less common sense reasons why such aggregating behaviour should have been favoured by natural selection have been suggested, and I will talk about some of them in Chapter 10. Wynne Edwards's idea is quite different. He proposes that when huge flocks of starlings mass at evening, or crowds of midges dance over a gatepost, they are performing a census of their population. Since he is supposing that individuals restrain their birth rates in the interest of the group as a whole and have fewer babies when the population density is high, it is reasonable that they should have some way of measuring the population density. Just so, a thermostat needs a thermometer as an integral part of its mechanism. For Wynne Edwards, epideictic behaviour is deliberately massing in crowds to facilitate population estimation. He is not suggesting conscious population estimation, but an automatic nervous or hormonal mechanism linking the individual's sensory perception of the density of their population with their reproductive systems. I've tried to do justice to Wynne Edwards's theory, even if rather briefly. If I have succeeded, you should now be feeling persuaded that it is, on the face of it, rather plausible. But the earlier chapters of this book should have prepared you to be sceptical, to the point of saying that, plausible as it may sound, the evidence for Wynne Edwards's theory had better be good, or else. And unfortunately, the evidence is not good. It consists of a large number of examples which could be interpreted in his way, but which could equally well be interpreted on more orthodox, selfish gene lines.
Although he would never have used that name, the chief architect of the selfish gene theory of family planning was the great ecologist David Lack. He worked especially on clutch size in wild birds, but his theories and conclusions have the merit of being generally applicable. Each bird species tends to have a typical clutch size. For instance, gannets and guillemots incubate one egg at a time, swifts three, great tits half a dozen or more. There is variation in this. Some swifts lay only two at a time, great tits may lay 12. It is reasonable to suppose that the number of eggs a female lays and incubates is at least partly under genetic control, like any other characteristic. That is to say, there may be a gene for laying two eggs, a rival allele for laying three, another allele for laying four, and so on, although in practice it is unlikely to be quite as simple as this. Now, the selfish gene theory requires us to ask which of these genes will become more numerous in the gene pool. Superficially, it might seem that the gene for laying four eggs is bound to have an advantage over the gene for laying three or two. A moment's reflection shows that this simple more means better argument cannot be true, however. It leads to the expectation that five eggs should be better than four, 10 better still, 100 even better, and infinity best of all. In other words, it leads logically to an absurdity. Obviously, there are costs as well as benefits in laying a large number of eggs. Increased bearing is bound to be paid for in less efficient caring. Lack's essential point is that for any given species, in any given environmental situation, there must be an optimal clutch size. Where he differs from Wynne Edwards is in his answer to the question, optimal from whose point of view? Wynne Edwards would say the important optimum to which all individuals should aspire is the optimum for the group as a whole. Lack would say each selfish individual chooses the clutch size that maximizes the number of children she rears. If three is the optimum clutch size for swifts, what this means for Lack is that any individual who tries to rear four will probably end up with fewer children than rival, more cautious individuals who only try to rear three. The obvious reason for this would be that the food is so thinly spread between the four babies that few of them survive to adulthood. This would be true both of the original allocation of yolk to the four eggs and of the food given to the babies after hatching. According to Lack, therefore, individuals regulate their clutch size for reasons that are anything but altruistic. They are not practicing birth control in order to avoid overexploiting the group's resources. They are practicing birth control in order to maximize the number of surviving children they actually have, an aim which is the very opposite of that which we normally associate with birth control.
Rearing baby birds is a costly business. The mother has to invest a large quantity of food and energy in manufacturing eggs. Possibly with her mate's help, she invests a large effort in building a nest to hold her eggs and protect them. Parents spend weeks patiently sitting on the eggs. Then, when the babies hatch out, the parents work themselves nearly to death fetching food for them, more or less non-stop without resting. As we've already seen, a parent great tit brings an average of one item of food to the nest every 30 seconds of daylight. Mammals, such as ourselves, do it in a slightly different way, but the basic idea of reproduction being a costly affair, especially for the mother, is no less true. It is obvious that if a parent tries to spread her limited resources of food and effort among too many children, she will end up rearing fewer than if she had set out with more modest ambitions. She has to strike a balance between bearing and caring. The total amount of food and other resources which an individual female or a mated pair can muster is the limiting factor determining the number of children they can rear. Natural selection, according to the lack theory, adjusts initial clutch size, litter size, etc., so as to take maximum advantage of these limited resources.
Individuals who have too many children are penalized not because the whole population goes extinct, but simply because fewer of their children survive. Genes for having too many children are just not passed on to the next generation in large numbers because few of the children bearing these genes reach adulthood. What has happened in modern civilized man is that family sizes are no longer limited by the finite resources that the individual parents can provide. If a husband and wife have more children than they can feed, the state, which means the rest of the population, simply steps in and keeps the surplus children alive and healthy. There is, in fact, nothing to stop a couple with no material resources at all having and rearing precisely as many children as the woman can physically bear. But the welfare state is a very unnatural thing. In nature, parents who have more children than they can support do not have many grandchildren, and their genes are not passed on to future generations. There is no need for altruistic restraint in the birth rate because there is no welfare state in nature. Any gene for overindulgence is promptly punished. The children containing that gene starve. Since we humans do not want to return to the old selfish ways where we let the children of two large families starve to death, we have abolished the family as a unit of economic self-sufficiency and substituted the state. But the privilege of guaranteed support for children should not be abused.
Contraception is sometimes attacked as unnatural. So it is, very unnatural. The trouble is, so is the welfare state. I think that most of us believe the welfare state is highly desirable. But you cannot have an unnatural welfare state unless you also have unnatural birth control. Otherwise the end result will be misery even greater than that which obtains in nature. The welfare state is perhaps the greatest altruistic system the animal kingdom has ever known. But any altruistic system is inherently unstable because it is open to abuse by selfish individuals ready to exploit it. Individual humans who have more children than they are capable of rearing are probably too ignorant in most cases to be accused of conscious, malevolent exploitation. Powerful institutions and leaders who deliberately encourage them to do so seem to me less free from suspicion.
Returning to wild animals, the lack clutch size argument can be generalized to all the other examples Wynne Edwards uses: territorial behavior, dominance hierarchies, and so on. Take, for instance, the red grouse that he and his colleagues have worked on. These birds eat heather, and they parcel out the moors in territories containing apparently more food than the territory owners actually need. Early in the season, they fight over territories, but after a while, the losers seem to accept that they have failed and do not fight any more. They become outcasts who never get territories, and by the end of the season, they've mostly starved to death. Only territory owners breed. That non-territory owners are physically capable of breeding is shown by the fact that if a territory owner is shot, his place is promptly filled by one of the former outcasts, who then breeds. Wynne Edwards' interpretation of this extreme territorial behaviour is, as we have seen, that the outcasts accept that they have failed to gain a ticket or licence to breed. They do not try to breed.
On the face of it, this seems an awkward example for the selfish gene theory to explain. Why don't the outcasts try and try again to oust a territory holder until they drop from exhaustion? They would seem to have nothing to lose. But wait, perhaps they do have something to lose. We have already seen that if a territory holder should happen to die, an outcast has a chance of taking his place, and therefore of breeding. If the odds of an outcast succeeding to a territory in this way are greater than the odds of his gaining one by fighting, then it may pay him, as a selfish individual, to wait in the hope that somebody will die, rather than squander what little energy he has in futile fighting. For Wynne Edwards, the role of the outcasts in the welfare of the group is to wait in the wings as understudies, ready to step into the shoes of any territory holder who dies on the main stage of group reproduction. We can now see that this may also be their best strategy purely as selfish individuals. As we saw in Chapter 4, we can regard animals as gamblers. The best strategy for a gambler may sometimes be a wait-and-hope strategy rather than a bull-at-a-gate strategy. Similarly, the many other examples where animals appear to accept non-reproductive status passively can be explained quite easily by the selfish gene theory. The general form of the explanation is always the same. The individual's best bet is to restrain himself for the moment in the hope of better chances in the future. A seal who leaves the harem holders unmolested is not doing it for the good of the group. He's biding his time, waiting for a more propitious moment. Even if the moment never comes and he ends up without descendants, the gamble might have paid off, though with hindsight we can see that for him it did not. And when lemmings flood in their millions away from the centre of a population explosion, they are not doing it in order to reduce the density of the area they leave behind. They are seeking, every selfish one of them, a less crowded place in which to live. The fact that any particular one may fail to find it and dies is something we can see with hindsight. It does not alter the likelihood that to stay behind would have been an even worse gamble.
It is a well-documented fact that overcrowding sometimes reduces birth rates. This is sometimes taken to be evidence for Wynne Edwards's theory. It is nothing of the kind. It is compatible with his theory, and it is also just as compatible with the selfish gene theory. For example, in one experiment, mice were put in an outdoor enclosure with plenty of food and allowed to breed freely. The population grew up to a point, then levelled off. The reason for the levelling off turned out to be that the females became less fertile as a consequence of overcrowding. They had fewer babies. This kind of effect has often been reported. Its immediate cause is often called stress, although giving it a name like that does not of itself help to explain it. In any case, whatever its immediate cause may be, we still have to ask about its ultimate or evolutionary explanation. Why does natural selection favour females who reduce their birth rate when their population is overcrowded? Wynne Edwards's answer is clear. Group selection favours groups in which the females measure the population and adjust their birth rates so that food supplies are not overexploited. In the condition of the experiment, it so happened that food was never going to be scarce, but the mice could not be expected to realise that. They are programmed for life in the wild, and it's likely that in natural conditions, overcrowding is a reliable indicator of future famine.
What does the selfish gene theory say? Almost exactly the same thing, but with one crucial difference. You will remember that according to Lack, animals will tend to have the optimum number of children from their own selfish point of view. If they bear too few or too many, they will end up rearing fewer than they would have if they had hit on just the right number. Now, just the right number is likely to be a smaller number in a year when the population is overcrowded than in a year when the population is sparse. We have already agreed that overcrowding is likely to foreshadow famine. Obviously, if a female is presented with reliable evidence that a famine is to be expected, it is in her own selfish interest to reduce her own birth rate. Rivals who do not respond to the warning signs in this way will end up rearing fewer babies, even if they actually bear more. We therefore end up with almost exactly the same conclusion as Wynne Edwards, but we get there by an entirely different type of evolutionary reasoning. The selfish gene theory has no trouble even with epidictic displays. You'll remember that Wynne Edwards hypothesized that animals deliberately display together in large crowds in order to make it easy for all the individuals to conduct a census and regulate their birth rates accordingly. There is no direct evidence that any aggregations are in fact epidictic, but just suppose some such evidence were found. Would the selfish gene theory be embarrassed? Not a bit.
Starlings roost together in huge numbers. Suppose it were shown not only that overcrowding in winter reduced fertility in the following spring, but that this was directly due to the birds listening to each other's calls. It might be demonstrated experimentally that individuals exposed to a tape recording of a dense and very loud starling roost laid fewer eggs than individuals exposed to a recording of a quieter, less dense roost. By definition, this would indicate that the calls of starlings constituted an epidictic display. The selfish gene theory would explain it in much the same way as it handled the case of the mice. Again, we start from the assumption that genes for having a larger family than you can support are automatically penalized and become less numerous in the gene pool. The task of an efficient egg layer is one of predicting what is going to be the optimum clutch size for her as a selfish individual in the coming breeding season. You will remember from Chapter 4 the special sense in which we are using the word prediction. Now, how can a female bird predict her optimum clutch size? What variables should influence her prediction? It may be that many species make a fixed prediction which does not change from year to year. Thus, on average, the optimum clutch size for a gannet is 1. It is possible that in particular bumper years for fish, the true optimum for an individual might temporarily rise to 2 eggs. If there is no way for gannets to know in advance whether a particular year is going to be a bumper one, we cannot expect individual females to take the risk of wasting their resources on 2 eggs when this would damage their reproductive success in an average year. But there may be other species, perhaps starlings, in which it is in principle possible to predict in winter whether the following spring is going to yield a good crop of some particular food resource. Country people have numerous old sayings suggesting that such clues as the abundance of holly berries may be good predictors of the weather in the coming spring. Whether any particular old wives' tale is accurate or not, it remains logically possible that there are such clues, and that a good prophet could, in theory, adjust her clutch size from year to year to her own advantage. Holly berries may be reliable predictors, or they may not, but, as in the case of the mice, it does seem quite likely that population density would be a good predictor. A female starling can in principle know that when she comes to feed her babies in the coming spring, she will be competing for food with rivals of the same species. If she can somehow estimate the local density of her own species in winter, this could provide her with a powerful means of predicting how difficult it is going to be to get food for babies next spring. If she found the winter population to be particularly high, her prudent policy from her own selfish point of view might well be to lay relatively few eggs. Her estimate of her own optimum clutch size would have been reduced.
Now, the moment it becomes true that individuals are reducing their clutch size on the basis of their estimate of population density, it will immediately be to the advantage of each selfish individual to pretend to rivals that the population is large, whether it really is or not. If starlings are estimating population size by the volume of noise in a winter roost, it would pay each individual to shout as loudly as possible in order to sound more like 2 starlings than 1. This idea of animals pretending to be several animals at once has been suggested in another context by J.R. Krebs and is named the Beaugest effect, after the novel in which a similar tactic was used by a unit of the French Foreign Legion. The idea in our case is to try to induce neighbouring starlings to reduce their clutch size to a level lower than the true optimum. If you are a starling who succeeds in doing this, it is to your selfish advantage, since you are reducing the numbers of individuals who do not bear your genes. I therefore conclude that Wynne Edwards's idea of epidictic displays may actually be a good idea. He may have been right all along, but for the wrong reasons. More generally, the lac type of hypothesis is powerful enough to account, in selfish gene terms, for all evidence that might seem to support the group selection theory, should any such evidence turn up. Our conclusion from this chapter is that individual parents practice family planning, but in the sense that they optimize their birth rates rather than restrict them for public good. They try to maximize the number of surviving children that they have, and this means having neither too many babies nor too few. Genes that make an individual have too many babies tend not to persist in the gene pool, because children containing such genes tend not to survive to adulthood.
So much then for quantitative considerations of family size. We now come on to conflicts of interest within families. Will it always pay a mother to treat all her children equally, or might she have favourites? Should the family function as a single cooperating whole, or are we to expect selfishness and deception even within the family? Will all members of a family be working towards the same optimum, or will they disagree about what the optimum is? These are the questions we try to answer in the next chapter. The related question of whether there may be conflict of interest between mates, we postpone until Chapter 9.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
And now, Part 2 of The Selfish Gene. Written by Richard Dawkins and read by Richard Dawkins and Lala Ward.
Chapter 8. Battle of the Generations. Let us begin by tackling the first of the questions posed at the end of the last chapter. Should a mother have favourites, or should she be equally altruistic towards all her children? At the risk of being boring, I must yet again throw in my customary warning. The word favourite carries no subjective connotations, and the word should, no moral ones. I am treating a mother as a machine, programmed to do everything in its power to propagate copies of the genes which ride inside it. Since you and I are humans, who know what it is like to have conscious purposes, it is convenient for me to use the language of purpose as a metaphor in explaining the behaviour of survival machines. In practice, what would it mean to say a mother had a favourite child? It would mean she would invest her resources unequally among her children. The resources that a mother has available to invest consist of a variety of things. Food is the obvious one, together with the effort expended in gathering food, since this in itself costs the mother something. Risk undergone in protecting young from predators is another resource, which the mother can spend or refuse to spend. Energy and time devoted to nest or home maintenance, protection from the elements, and in some species, time spent in teaching children, are valuable resources which a parent can allocate to children equally or unequally as she chooses.
It is difficult to think of a common currency in which to measure all these resources that a parent can invest. Just as human societies use money as a universally convertible currency which can be translated into food or land or labouring time, so we require a currency in which to measure resources that an individual survival machine may invest in another individual's life, in particular a child's life. A measure of energy, such as the calorie, is tempting, and some ecologists have devoted themselves to the accounting of energy costs in nature. This is inadequate, though, because it is only loosely convertible into the currency that really matters, the gold standard of evolution, gene survival. R.L. Trivers, in 1972, neatly solved the problem with his concept of parental investment, although reading between the close-packed lines, one feels that Sir Ronald Fisher, the greatest biologist of the 20th century, meant much the same thing in 1930 by his parental expenditure.
End note. Robert Trivers, whose papers of the early 1970s were among the most important inspirations for me in writing the first edition of this book, and whose ideas especially dominated Chapter 8, has finally produced his own book, Social Evolution. I recommend it not only for its content, but for its style, clear thinking academically correct, but with just enough anthropomorphic irresponsibility to tease the pompous and spiced with personal autobiographical asides. I cannot resist quoting one of these. It is so characteristic. Crivers is describing his excitement on observing the relationship between two rival male baboons in Kenya. There was another reason for my excitement, and this was an unconscious identification with Arthur. Arthur was a superb young male in his prime. Trivers's new chapter on parent-offspring conflict brings the subject up to date. There is indeed rather little to add to his paper of 1974, apart from some new factual examples. The theory has stood the test of time. More detailed mathematical and genetic models have confirmed that Trivers's largely verbal arguments do indeed follow from currently accepted Darwinian theory.
Parental investment, PI, is defined as any investment by the parent in an individual offspring that increases the offspring's chance of surviving, and hence reproductive success, at the cost of the parent's ability to invest in other offspring. The beauty of Trivers' parental investment is that it is measured in units very close to the units that really matter. When a child uses up some of its mother's milk, the amount of milk consumed is measured not in pints, not in calories, but in units of detriment to other children of the same mother. For instance, if a mother has two babies, X and Y, and X drinks one pint of milk, a major part of the PI that this pint represents is measured in units of increased probability that Y will die because he did not drink that pint. PI is measured in units of decrease in life expectancy of other children born or yet to be born. Parental investment is not quite an ideal measure because it overemphasizes the importance of parentage as against other genetic relationships. Ideally, we should use a generalized altruism investment measure. Individual A may be said to invest in individual B when A increases B's chance of surviving at the cost of A's ability to invest in other individuals, including herself, all costs being weighted by the appropriate relatedness. Thus, a parent's investment in any one child should ideally be measured in terms of detriment to life expectancy not only of other children, but also of nephews, nieces, herself, etc. In many respects, however, this is just a quibble, and Trivers's measure is well worth using in practice.
Now, any particular adult individual has, in her whole lifetime, a certain total quantity of PI available to invest in children, and other relatives and in herself, but for simplicity we consider only children. This represents the sum of all the food she can gather or manufacture in a lifetime of work, all the risks she is prepared to take, and all the energy and effort that she is able to put into the welfare of children. How should a young female, setting out on her adult life, invest her life's resources? What would be a wise investment policy for her to follow? We've already seen from the Lack theory that she should not spread her investment too thinly among too many children. That way she will lose too many genes, she won't have enough grandchildren. On the other hand, she must not devote all her investment to too few children, spoiled brats. She may virtually guarantee herself some grandchildren, but rivals who invest in the optimum number of children will end up with more grandchildren. So much for even-handed investment policies. Our present interest is in whether it could ever pay a mother to invest unequally among her children, that is, in whether she should have favourites. The answer is that there is no genetic reason for a mother to have favourites. Her relatedness to all her children is the same, one half. Her optimal strategy is to invest equally in the largest number of children that she can rear to the age when they have children of their own. But, as we've already seen, some individuals are better life insurance risks than others. An undersized runt bears just as many of his mother's genes as his more thriving littermates, but his life expectation is less. Another way to put this is that he needs more than his fair share of parental investment just to end up equal to his brothers. Depending on the circumstances, it may pay a mother to refuse to feed a runt and allocate all of his share of her parental investment to his brothers and sisters. Indeed, it may pay her to feed him to his brothers and sisters, or to eat him herself and use him to make milk. Mother pigs do sometimes devour their young, but I do not know whether they pick especially on runts.
Runts constitute a particular example. We can make some more general predictions about how a mother's tendency to invest in a child might be affected by his age. If she has a straight choice between saving the life of one child or saving the life of another, and if the one she does not save is bound to die, she should prefer the older one. This is because she stands to lose a higher proportion of her life's parental investment if he dies than if his little brother dies. Perhaps a better way to put this is that if she saves the little brother, she will still have to invest some costly resources in him just to get him up to the age of the big brother. On the other hand, if the choice is not such a stark life or death choice, her best bet might be to prefer the younger one. For instance, suppose her dilemma is whether to give a particular morsel of food to a little child or a big one. The big one is likely to be more capable of finding his own food unaided. Therefore, if she stopped feeding him, he would not necessarily die. On the other hand, the little one, who is too young to find food for himself, would be more likely to die if his mother gave the food to his big brother. Now, even though the mother would prefer the little brother to die rather than the big brother, she may still give the food to the little one because the big one is unlikely to die anyway. This is why mammal mothers wean their children rather than going on feeding them indefinitely throughout their lives. There comes a time in the life of a child when it pays the mother to divert investment from him into future children. When this moment comes, she will want to wean him. A mother who had some way of knowing that she'd had her last child might be expected to continue to invest all her resources in him for the rest of her life and perhaps suckle him well into adulthood. Nevertheless, she should weigh up whether it would not pay her more to invest in grandchildren or nephews and nieces, since although these are half as closely related to her as her own children, their capacity to benefit from her investment may be more than double that of one of her own children.
This seems a good moment to mention the puzzling phenomenon known as the menopause, the rather abrupt termination of a human female's reproductive fertility in middle age. This may not have occurred too commonly in our wild ancestors, since not many women would have lived that long anyway. But still, the difference between the abrupt change of life in women and the gradual fading out of fertility in men suggests that there is something genetically deliberate about the menopause, that it is an adaptation. It is rather difficult to explain. At first sight, we might expect that a woman should go on having children until she dropped, even if advancing years made it progressively less likely that any individual child would survive. Surely it would seem always worth trying. But we must remember that she's also related to her grandchildren, though half as closely. For various reasons, perhaps connected with the Medawar theory of aging we met in Chapter 3, women in the natural state became gradually less efficient at bringing up children as they got older. Therefore, the life expectancy of a child of an old mother was less than that of a child of a young mother. This meant that if a woman had a child and a grandchild born on the same day, the grandchild could expect to live longer than the child. When a woman reached the age where the average chance of each child reaching adulthood was just less than half the chance of each grandchild of the same age reaching adulthood, any gene for investing in grandchildren in preference to children would tend to prosper. Such a gene is carried by only 1 in 4 grandchildren, whereas the rival gene is carried by 1 in 2 children, but the greater expectation of life of the grandchildren outweighs this, and the grandchild altruism gene prevails in the gene pool. A woman could not invest fully in her grandchildren if she went on having children of her own. Therefore, genes for becoming reproductively infertile in middle age became more numerous, since they were carried in the bodies of grandchildren whose survival was assisted by grandmotherly altruism. This is a possible explanation for the evolution of the menopause in females. The reason why the fertility of males tails off gradually rather than abruptly is probably that males do not invest so much as females in each individual child anyway. Provided he can sire children by young women, it will always pay even a very old man to invest in children rather than in grandchildren.
So far in this chapter and in the last, we have seen everything from the parents' point of view.